summer gear, huh? Okay. You have your nice white shorts on. And so we're going to do a little question and answer and a little review of Rinpoche's first lecture on the second year of teaching Uttara Tantra. This year he's teaching about the Buddha jewel, Dharma jewel, and the Sangha jewel. Yeah, last year he mainly taught about the beginning of the text, the seven Vajra points, and especially a little bit about Buddha nature, about the emptiness of the mind. So, first of all, let me ask, do you have any questions about what Rinpoche talked about last time? Yes. What was your name again? Jesse. You have to speak up, Jesse. Okay.
My question is regarding the nature of the mind being inherently existing and how that relates to the mind being truly existing. Now, Rinpoche said that they are exactly the same.
Right, but he didn't say the mind is truly existing or inherently existing. According to the most subtle philosophical school, what we call the consequent school, the Prasangika school, no phenomena, including the mind, no phenomena is truly existing. No phenomena is inherently existing. So there was a little bit confusion because that terminology was used in the mind-only school, the Chittamatra school, sometimes called the Yogacara school. In that, they say that some phenomena are truly existing. Ordinary phenomena, dependent phenomena, truly exist. And the thoroughly established phenomena of emptiness truly exists. But only the imaginary phenomena do not truly exist. But the Prasangika says that's beyond what is reasonable. No phenomena truly exist. No phenomena are inherently existing. So when we talk about the nature of the Buddha's mind, one of these first qualities here, what we were talking about is the emptiness of that, of an imagined true existence. Now it's not as though, you know, it's something that philosophers say there's some true existence and there's some debate about whether there is or there isn't. It actually is the way that phenomena appear to us, undoubtedly, without any kind of philosophical training or thinking. Phenomena appear to us as though they were real. You know, you say, excuse me, George, that's real. There is a real cup there. I'm a real person. That's my real car. That's my real hamburger, you know, or a real tofu, excuse me. Gelato. That's really good. It's really, really good. You know, like as though things really, truly exist. So the fact is, if one were to investigate, you could find out that phenomena don't exist the way that they appear. And the mind itself, the Buddha's mind, is empty of true existence. That's one of the first qualities here. Does that help a little bit? So it wasn't talking so much that phenomena were truly existent as saying that they are not truly existent. Okay, so you'll have another question, but you're leaving the floor for someone else. Yeah. Okay. Could you? Yeah, sure. Just turn it off. That's okay. There's no need. Yeah, no problem. It's good. Yeah. Emptiness is also not truly existent. Emptiness is also empty of true existence. When we say empty, it doesn't mean non-existent. It means that the things are devoid of a certain existence that our mind accepts as being there because they appear that way. Like the example of a mirage. Could we say a mirage is empty of water? Would you have a feeling what that means? Or the reflection in a mirror of your face is empty of a real face. Although someone else might come in and be fooled, not seeing you and just seeing the reflection, thinking they're talking to you directly, that is actually empty of a real face. A mirage is empty of water. So in that sense, phenomena seem to have a real findable existence. Even emptiness seems to have a findable existence, which it is devoid of. Okay, so emptiness is also empty. And the bodhisattvas, as they progress along the path, that's one of the things that they hone their understanding of emptiness on, understanding that particular fact, that emptiness itself is also empty. I mean, we should be able to understand that if a bodhisattva was understanding emptiness for the first time, they would have a sort of understanding of that, but along the path, they particularly, at other points, they would spend some time honing, you know, that understanding that even emptiness itself is empty. All phenomena are empty. There is no phenomena that is truly existent.
Which then means that the absolute view, though, is that all emptiness is totally free of any kind of concepts, mental constructs.
Say that again.
Isn't that the absolute level of it? Is that even emptiness is empty of all kind of, you know, definitions, concepts?
Well, we could say maybe final level. When we say absolute, we sometimes run into a problem because it kind of has the implication of being something that's real or true or something. In the final analysis, phenomena have two kinds of modes of existence, all phenomena. The mode of existence that we call their conventional existence, which is one in which they're merely designated by the mind. This is a wristwatch. This is a pair of eyeglasses. This is a glass of water. But there is nothing from its own side that can be found. You know, there's no wristwatchness here, no eyeglassness here that can be found as some philosophical analyses might think. Phenomena do exist conventionally as thoughts and concepts. So it's not as though thoughts and concepts have no meaning. But on the level of ultimate reality, from the point of view of their ultimate truth, phenomena are empty of true existence. And within that sphere of experience, in meditation on emptiness, one can have a conceptual understanding of emptiness, which depends on concepts. But finally, what one tries to do is to develop a non-conceptual realization of emptiness. So that is something which is beyond thought. And when it talks about here in verse 5, not realized through the cause of others, one of the factors that we were talking about last time, talking about also, it cannot be expressed in words, the actual flavor, in the sense that, say for instance, I can see Midian outside savoring a strawberry smoothie? Mango smoothie? So, for instance, the flavor of that, even he would tell us what it was, until you'd actually tasted that, you wouldn't know exactly the experience of that. You know, if someone explains something that you had not experienced before. So it's beyond expression, inexpressible in that way. It doesn't mean that when we say that emptiness is inexpressible, it doesn't mean that it can't be expressed at all, that words and concepts can't lead you in that direction. In fact, we have to depend on words, concepts, and expressions in order to first understand emptiness conceptually. But the actual flavor of it, the actual experience of it in direct realization, is something that can't be expressed in words. Okay? So while we're...
When Rinpoche was talking about uncompounded, he said that one meaning of that is that you cannot establish a beginning or an end to the emptiness of the Buddha's mind. And I don't understand why you can't establish a beginning to the emptiness of the Buddha's mind, because can't you establish the point when an ordinary mental consciousness becomes completely...
Okay, so that's kind of an interesting thing. Like, for instance, when we talked about the emptiness of a cup or glass, we sometimes call it a temporal permanent phenomena, something which is permanent during the duration. The emptiness of the cup only exists when the cup exists. So you would think that the emptiness of the Buddha's mind obviously only exists when the Buddha's mind exists. But I think what is mentioned here about beginning, middle, and end, what is that coming in the next, in verse 6, because of having a nature without beginning, middle, and end, what it means is there's no truly existent production of the Buddha's mind. While it's existing, there's no truly existent, in the middle, you might say, abidance. And when it disappears, it doesn't disappear in a way that the cessation of it is truly existent. Does that give some that? So it's not talking about the way that you and I would be talking about, let's say, the emptiness of the glass does come into existence at a certain time, conventionally, when the glass is imputed. Before that, there was no emptiness of the glass, because emptiness is not something that exists independently. It depends upon its the object that it's referring to. Okay, Michelle.
Okay, I maybe just didn't understand this correctly, but I thought that it was said that the Buddha's loving compassion is ever enhancing. So that confused me with uncompounded.
Ever enhancing.
Yeah, I thought that was the.
Does it say it here in the translation, or is that?
The translation. I made a note of it. Buddha's loving compassion is ever enhancing. Did I misunderstand
that? Well, she may have said that, but I'm not sure what Sayang La was translating at that point. We could say that the Buddha's loving compassion is all encompassing.
Yeah, that I could understand.
Ever enhancing. I'm not quite sure what she thought that meant, because English is not her native. Language. Sometimes she'll say something that sounds to her that's right, but it may not make exact sense to us. I'm not sure ever enhancing. I think it means all encompassing. So, yeah. So let's see. Go through some other things. Don.
To not realize through the cause of others.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I understood Rinpoche to say that means that others can't see the Buddha. But that sounds to me like the Buddha is not caused by some other cause, by some other being, that he caused his mind. He caused your own Buddha.
Now, again, I think this means...
There are probably lots of different levels of meaning, but on this one, on this level, how does our text translate it? Realized, not being realized through the cause of others... And then in verse 7 it says, because of being realized by oneself individually, it is not realized through the cause of others. So let's go back. Verse 4 of the text, which we covered a little bit last year, is kind of like a general condensation of these qualities of Buddhahood. Okay. Verse 5 is now beginning to unpack that a bit. You ever hear that expression when they talk about commentaries? Unravel or unpack that explanation, sort of explain it in more detail. And 6, 7, and I guess 8 also is talking about the qualities that are mentioned in verse 5. So when you see the thing, these 8 qualities of Buddhahood. Buddhahood has 8 qualities because of being uncompounded, spontaneous, not realized through the cause of others. Buddhahood has knowledge, mercy, and power. Those are 6. And then as well as being the fulfillment of the 2 aims, oneself and others. So that makes 8 qualities, right? So here, when it talks about not realized through the cause of others, that has to do with this inexpressibility of Buddha's, of the realization of the Buddha experience, that the final direct experience of emptiness by the Buddha's mind is not something which is brought about by the explanation of others. It's something that has to be realized by oneself individually. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So, but that's not the same as saying that there are causes for Buddhahood, causes and conditions. It's like, okay, so we're all wanting, we're all going to become Buddhas.
There are causes and conditions of Buddhahood.
Oh.
But when we talk about the
emptiness of the Buddha's mind, emptiness itself, this is a little bit, that's why a text like this is something very, very amenable to a lot of study, because it's easily misunderstood on the first level. When it's talking about not having causes and conditions, we're talking about the emptiness of a Buddha's mind being an uncompounded phenomena, being permanent. It doesn't change moment by moment. It's not as though it's a little bit empty and it gets a little bit fuller and sort of oscillating and due to causes and conditions. It is from the moment an individual attains enlightenment, Buddhahood, that individual's mind from the very start is empty of true existence. It remains empty of true existence. That's the nature of all phenomena.
And that's without beginning, right? That emptiness.
No, it's talking about, when it talks about
no beginning here, I think what it's talking about, it's not saying that our Buddha experience has no beginning. It's not saying that the emptiness of our future Buddhahood has no beginning. It does have a beginning, but it doesn't have an inherently existent beginning. So, for instance, one of the things we talk about when we try to study emptiness is the activity of things that we experience, ordinary conventional phenomena, coming into being, their production, and their abidance for some time. They seem to abide. Actually, they're changing every moment. They disintegrate and rise the next instant. And their eventual seeming cessation or disintegration. Right? That's what we notice in life. Someone's born, they're alive, they pass away. We meet friends, we remain with them, we separate. We get money, we have it, we spend it, or the government takes it away, or whatever. So those phenomena are being labeled here, beginning, middle, and end. It's not as though the Buddha's mind has no beginning, but it has no inherently existent beginning in the sense of being inherently produced. The act of something coming about, being produced, is something that is analyzed in the great texts by the great Indian pundits that studied Buddha's teachings. The Buddha actually explained, when phenomena arise, they don't arise from themselves as though there was something already existing. Most of us wouldn't have that doubt, although some philosophical schools think in the seed there's a miniature sprout already existing. We might say, well, there is, and it's like in the lima bean, if you open up near the time it's sprouting, there's a semi, you know, looks like the sprout already there. But that's, many philosophical schools thought that phenomena could only come into existence if they already existed before, and they just sort of manifested themselves. They were unmanifest, and then they manifested. So phenomena don't arise in that way. Generally, phenomena arise from something else. The sprout arises from the seed, conventionally. But it doesn't arise, it is not produced inherently or truly in the way that our mind thinks. One minute there's the seed, the next minute there's a sprout. If you analyze that particular kind of production, or let's say production in general, a sprout arising from a seed which is other than itself. If it was an inherent production or true production, the seed and the sprout would have to be inherently existing. And they would have to be inherently other. They would have no relationship whatsoever, so that the sprout could not arise from the seed. You couldn't have a relationship. So that's a little bit of the kind of the analysis that's being hinted at here. So it's the meaning of beginning, middle, and end here is not just ordinary. It's talking about from a point of view of its being truly produced, truly abiding, and truly ceasing. Okay? So let me ask you a question while you're thinking of another question. Maybe you have another question to ask. Which of these qualities are qualities for oneself, one's own aim, and which of the Buddha's, you know, say the Buddha qualities for the Buddha's own aim, and which of them are for the aims of others? Do you remember what Rinpoche said? First three are for self. So generally when we talk about the spiritual path, there are two kinds of aims. In Tibetan we say rangdon and shendong. Rang means self, that one's own aim or purpose, and shendong means the purpose of others, so the aim of others. So when we talk about the Buddha experience, what part of the Buddha experience is for the benefit of others? Darcy, do you know?
Of the Buddha
experience, let's say the Buddha's bodies, the four bodies.
The Rupakaya, the
Nirmanakaya. The Rupakaya. And
Sabodhikaya. So the Rupakaya has two. Rupakaya means form body, right? Dharmakaya. Sometimes we can divide up the Buddha experiences into two. The form body, Rupakaya, and the Dharmakaya, or truth body. You might translate it on that level. And you can divide up the Rupakaya into two, the Nirmanakaya and the Sambhogakaya. So as Darcy's saying, the Rupakaya is manifested, the Buddha's manifest bodies, visible bodies, gross and more subtle, for the welfare of others. If there were no other beings that were needy of help, the Buddha would not have to manifest the Nirmanakaya and Sambhogakaya. So supposedly there's some debates in the monasteries about this. The last Buddha. Maybe someone can write a screenplay for this. I mean, Pat will help you with the screenplay. The last Buddha. So the last Buddha, there's no one else, no other sentient being around, so no need for that last Buddha to manifest these other two bodies, the Sambhogakaya and the Nirmanakaya. So sometimes they say the last Buddha will only have two bodies, the Dharmakaya and, you know, the wisdom Dharmakaya and the nature Dharmakaya. So those, it said that the truth body or Dharmakaya is for one's own purpose. Could you explain why, Darcy? Why is it for, you know, let's say the person, say when Darcy attains enlightenment, or she's not already, why is her Dharmakaya said to be for her own purpose, the attainment of that?
What does that mean?
It would be the omniscience of my own mind, right? The wisdom Dharmakaya.
That's one part of the Dharmakaya, the wisdom Dharmakaya.
So my mind needs to be abiding in that wisdom. So that's a mind.
Well, that Dharmakaya also experiences continual bliss and no problems, right? And that itself, that culmination, I mean, what do we want? We want to get out of this place, right? We want to have happiness, big happiness, permanent happiness, substantial happiness, you know, the real thing. And that can only be attained when one achieves enlightenment. Even until that time, things are not totally copacetic. No, this is anyone old enough to remember copacetic? Technical talk. That's philosophical technical talk. No, I'm joking. So the experience of the Dharmakaya is for one's own welfare, because that's what generally we're motivated as an ordinary person in the world now, out of our own welfare, right? We want to find food and housing and friends to take care of us. And sometimes people are said to be a little bit altruistic when they take other people into consideration. They help others, they raise a family and they take care of their children or their helpers, they take care of they teach children, or they take care of other people, or they work with an altruistic intention. So even in the world, we see self, you know, aims that are for one's own benefit and aims that are for others. So the Buddha experience has that same kind of sense. So that's in terms of the four bodies. Now, in terms of these eight qualities, what was your name again? I forget. Bob said what? The first three are for one's own self. And so what are those first three qualities?
Being uncompounded, spontaneous, and not being realized through cause of others.
So what is that? What does that mean? What are those three, those words, what are they referring to?
Well, I would, in my limited knowledge, would say probably the first and the third means it's free of the cycle of dependent origination. There's no beginning, no end, and it's not dependent on any preceding or following factors for its existence.
Mm. Any other ideas, Jennifer? What do you think?
Do you have a wee idea? Look at what it says in verse 6. When we talk about the uncompounded, uncompounded is talking about the emptiness of the Buddha's mind, right? The spontaneous is referring to the svavavikakaya. This is because of possessing the quiescent truth body, it is said to be spontaneous. And because of being realized by oneself individually, it is not realized through the cause of others. So, when we talk about these two bodies that are for one's own welfare, one of them is called the nature body, the nature dharmakaya, the svavavikakaya, and one of them is called the wisdom dharmakaya. Which of those three are talking about what? What do you think? Talking about you? The mind? Well, there's three things that are mentioned, but there's only two bodies that are for one's own welfare. So how do you divide them up? That's my question. Who's an idea? Are you guys following at all? You completely lost? You have some idea? What do you think?
Well, the uncompounded is referring to, I would assume, because uncompounded is referring to emptiness, right? The fact that the Dharmakaya is empty. So both of the wisdom body and the nature body are both empty of true existence. So perhaps it's referring to both of the bodies. But the emptiness itself is the nature body mm-hmm. of the Buddha.
So when we talk about the
nature body, there's two kinds of purity of the nature body. So maybe that's what's being referred to here. One of them's called the purity of adventitious stains and the purity of natural stains. Okay, when we talk about the Buddha's mind, like our mind right now, is our mind empty of true existence the same as the Buddha's, or is our mind not, what do you think? You don't think our mind is empty of true existence, right? Buddha's mind is empty of true existence, but ours is not? Yeah.
Our conventional existence, that it's not, but were we in touch with the more ultimate being of ourselves, yes, there it is.
So you think in our conventional existence, our mind is not empty of true existence? Actually, from a Buddhist perspective, it is empty of true existence, but we may not realize that. We may grasp to exactly the opposite, just like a person in the desert might think that the mirage is actually water. It's not as though the mirage is water, is it?
No.
It's actually empty of water from the beginning, but until you realize that, you may be grasping at it as water. Okay, that's our experience now.
That's what I thought it meant to be in conventional existence, was to be not realizing I don't know if I'm using the right words, but what is really so.
In a sense, I think that's right, but almost I may have misunderstood what you said. I got the impression you were saying that while we're still in conventional existence, our mind is not empty of true existence. Actually, it is empty of true existence in the same way that the mirage from the very beginning, even when you think there's water, is empty of water.
No, I get
that. Okay.
What
okay.
I mean is that when we though are, and I may be using the wrong words, when we are deluded about reality, and that's what I was calling being in conventional existence, then we don't know whether it's water or not water.
Right,
or what it
that's
is.
True, but it
doesn't change what it is.
It doesn't change what it is, right? Okay, so our mind is empty of true existence. So in one sense, we have a natural purity of our mind now. The Buddha's mind is naturally pure. Natural purity means pure of any kind of inherent existence, which never existed there, but is conceived to exist by ignorant people like ourselves. Okay, so we could say, by analogy, we could say the mirage is naturally pure of water. Okay, from the very beginning. So, but also, although our mind is empty of true existence and the Buddha's mind is empty of true existence, isn't there a difference between our mind and the Buddha's mind? Darcy's going to answer this one.
Because the basis is different. Someone asked that question, right?
Yeah.
The basis is different. That's true. But what's the interesting thing here, I think, is the Buddha's mind is empty of, is free, is pacified of adventitious stains also. Now, our mind, see, both of our minds are free of the natural stain of true existence. That natural stain is only imagined. It's never there from the beginning, right? Our mind, Buddha's mind, exactly the same. But our mind has delusions, afflictions. We, in Sanskrit, say klesha, anger, attachment, pride, jealousy, attachment, so much attachment, wanting to have friends and be happy and successful and so forth. Jealousy, depression, all of these are afflicted states of mind that the Buddha's mind is completely free of, right? So the Buddha's mind has two kinds of purity. The natural purity, which was, there was never a stain of true existence from the beginning, which our mind has, and it is free of adventitious stains. That is, it doesn't have any delusions whatsoever. No anger, no attachment. Even you criticize the Buddha, put he or she down, him or her, what should I say? Put him or her or he or she down. Put him down. Put him or her. Or if there's no gender, yeah, put it down. No anger arises, no depression, so forth. So, but what's the difference? The svavavikakaya still, our mind, the emptiness of our mind right now is not called the svavavikakaya because the basis of our mind, even though our mind is empty of true existence, like the emptiness of the Buddha's mind, because the basis is different, our mind has delusions, it is not called the nature body. Okay, the emptiness of our mind is called what? No, the emptiness of our mind is called the mess? No. Emptiness of our mind is called what? Do you know, Venerable? The Buddha potential. That Buddha potential, as we purify the Buddha potential, that was one of the things Rinpoche talked about last year, we get closer and closer to our mind being the omniscient mind, and closer and closer to the emptiness of our mind being the nature body. Right now, the emptiness of our mind is called Buddha potential. At the time of Buddhahood, the emptiness of our mind is called the nature body, or svavavikakaya. Okay, so of these three qualities here, two of them are talking about purities. One of them is talking about natural purity. One of them is talking about the purity of adventitious stains. Does that make sense to you? Do you know that word adventitious? It's not a word that we use in grade school. Do you know what adventitious means? Adventitious means something that comes about temporarily because of causes and conditions. It's not there from the beginning. So adventitious stains are like the delusions in our mind. You might say they were there from the beginning, beginningless time, but they are not part and parcel of our mind. They're due to the continuity of grasping of ignorance in our mind. So the Buddha experience is one, the purity of the Buddha's mind is of two kinds. One is the purity of these adventitious stains, what we could just call all of the delusions that we have, all the garbage. And it's also pure of any kind of imagined stain of true existence that's called the natural purity. So those are two of the factors here. And the third factor is talking about the wisdom dharmakaya. So two of them are talking about the svavivekakaya. One of them is, because remember, of these three factors, they're all, the first three are for one's own welfare, right? So two of them are talking about the svavivekakaya. One of them is talking about the wisdom dharmakaya, which realizes, besides emptiness, realizes the varieties of phenomena, the conventional phenomena, all of the different kinds of phenomena. So see if you can, as you read these, maybe Rinpoche will go into more detail today. I'm not sure whether he's going to go up to the Dharma verses or whether he's going to mention about that. Then of the other three qualities, here it says knowledge, mercy, and power. And Sayan La was saying last time what she thought it should be potential. What are these three? Is this something you've never heard of before? Well, maybe skillful means, but like, for instance, on the tantras, oftentimes in tantra also, we talk about the lords of the three families. What are they? Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, and Vajrapani, that represent these three quintessential qualities of the Buddha experience. What are they? Wisdom. Well, Avalokiteshvara representing ultimate compassion. Manjushri representing the knowledge of the Buddha. And Vajrapani? Pardon? Power. Power or ability. So here, the power or ability is, you know, Venerable Thupten Pemo asked last time, what was that power? Was it something different than compassion and wisdom? It was the ability to put compassion and wisdom into effect to bring about an end of the suffering of sentient beings. So I think in the previous verse, in verse 4, which we didn't, we touched on a little last year, but not so much now. Near the end of it, in our translation, what does it say? And who carrying the supreme sword and diamond of knowledge, it's actually Vajra of knowledge, or the supreme Vajra sword of knowledge, and mercy, that is wisdom and compassion, cuts the sprouts of suffering and destroys the walls of doubt that are surrounded by the darkness of various views. So kind of the implication here is, you know, the sword that Manjushri carries, where is it? Which hand is he holding it in? Right hand. What does that sword represent? Pat, do you know? Sword of Manjushri? Mahayana. It's a wisdom sword, as Venerable said. But actually, it's not exactly the wisdom sword of only wisdom, because even the hearers and solitary realizers realize emptiness, right? They have that wisdom, but they're not said to hold a sword of Manjushri. That sword represents a combination, as in that verse 4, a combination of compassion and comprehension. Our translation, what does it say? Knowledge and mercy. Okay? And the wielding of that, the ability to use that to cut off within the minds of others due to the Buddha's power, is that exercise of power, that kind of special ability that's exemplified by Vajrapani, and when we talk about Tantra and so forth. Okay, so these three qualities are the ones that you've heard about many times: wisdom, compassion, and power. And then the last two of the eight qualities kind of summarize the first six, those that are aims of the two aims, one's own aim and the aim of others. Sometimes in some of the sadhanas, maybe you say, and to make some connection with tantric things that without hopefully violating any kind of tantric secrecy. Sometimes in sadhanas, you imagine light radiates out from a seed syllable. What do they usually say? Accomplishing the two aims. So what in that context, what are the two aims? Same thing, right? One's own aim. So what are in that context, what are the things that the light rays usually do? Do you know, Venerable Dina?
Establish the beings in being a Buddha?
Yeah, they sort of bring about the welfare of sentient beings. It sort of, you know, radiates out and teaches that, you know, it could be very elaborate. It can light rays come and first eliminates their suffering so that they're amenable to listening to the Dharma. Right? You still there? Did you see something interesting, I think?
Checking.
So it eliminates their suffering so they can listen to the Dharma, provides cooperative conditions, teaches them, eventually leads them on the path even of Tantra, you know, that, like little emanations. So that would be for the welfare of others. What about for one's own welfare? What do those light rays do for one's own welfare? Does anyone know? Anyone do some? Dorji, do you do some practices? Yeah, I think that's right. I think that the light rays that go out and make offerings to the Buddhas, some of which are the outer offerings, the inner offerings, the secret offerings, the suchness offerings, those indeed are done for one's own welfare. So accomplishing the two aims, that means by collecting merit and wisdom through those kinds of activities, making offerings and in order to meditate on the secret and suchness offerings, you have to secret and suchness offerings. You have to have an understanding of emptiness. So you're collecting these two collections that bring about these Buddha experiences, especially the one's own welfare. Okay. So these verses, these eight qualities of Buddha, and there'll be eight qualities of Dharma and Sangha, are in some of the Lanrim texts that some of the previous Dalai Lamas wrote, the Path of Bliss and the Quick Path. When they talk about the definition of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in the section on refuge, they actually mention, as it said in the Uttara Tantra, in the Sublime Continuum, Gyulama, the Buddha has these eight qualities. So what are the usual qualities? When we talk about refuge, what are the usual things we talk about? What are the four qualities?
Fearlessness.
Yeah. So oftentimes we talk about these three things, the wisdom, compassion, and power of the Buddha. We also talk about the Buddha being having compassion for all beings and having equanimity, as the example that was given in the teachings about if someone is cutting the Buddha from one side and applying sandalwood paste on the others. We don't do that in America, do we, in Santa Cruz? Do you put on sandalwood paste to someone that you really like? What would be the example? One side, you know, sticking someone with a knife or something, and the other side, what would you be doing? Massage with aromatic oils or, you know, something like that. So that's kind of the meaning. Whatever an individual is doing, the Buddha has infinite compassion So we talk about the qualities of the Buddha's body. We talk about the 32 major marks and so forth. And we talk about the Buddha's mind. So all of those things are encompassed in these, if you expand these eight qualities, you can kind of use that as an outline to talk about those. You talk about the Buddha's mind having these qualities, uncompounded, spontaneous, and not realized through the cause of others. And then knowledge, mercy, and power, those particular manifestations here being the qualities for the welfare of others, because the wisdom here is not just the Buddha's own wisdom that knows phenomena for himself or herself, but because it's talked about for the welfare of others, right? When it's talked about knowledge, mercy, and power, those are said the three to be for the welfare of others. So that's like the sword of wisdom and compassion that is used with power to alleviate the sprouts of ignorance in the minds of other sentient beings. Okay. So maybe Rinpoche will continue a little bit more about 6, 7, and 8. Maybe he has already, in a sense, covered those without us knowing, and he'll begin Dharma tonight. I don't know. We'll see. But why don't we leave right there so we have a little chance to prepare.